Yeah, see, it says record.
Okay. And then stop.
Yeah, it usually goes across. It's not going across. It usually bounces across, I thought. Oh, up on top it is. Up on top. See that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, so it's recording.
Okay,
so,
and stop.
You can just hit again, and it continues.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Executive Board open session. I call the meeting to order. Today's date is Thursday, August the 6th, and it's right about, 10 a.m. or so?
Yeah. Close enough.
So, for the agenda for today...
We have to call the roll?
Yeah, that's going to be all part of that. So I'm going to do a roll call up front, and then we're going to do a vote on our meeting minutes from July. We're going to... we're going to have an open vote on our budget for the year. Then we'll have Vice President of Finance Chuck Unruh is going to give a summary of the year-end financials. Is Hal Terry in the room?
Yes.
Okay, so Hal will give an update for all of us on the executive board about what's been the discussions that he's picked up on during his, you know, meetings here on the future of the U.S. Open. And then we'll have a brief discussion about the executive board's plans for meetings during the coming year. And then at the end, we'll open it up for questions that are due from any of the members. Okay, so I'll go ahead and call the roll. Myself, Michael Hoffpower, President, I'm present. Vice President Bauer?
Present.
Vice President of Finance Unruh?
Present.
Executive Secretary Ryan Velez? Ryan has said that he's not going to be available for today, and I even offered to, if he would want to dial in by phone, and he said no, he's not going to be able to. So Executive Secretary Velez is not present. A member at large, David Day.
Present.
Member at large, Fun Fong.
Present.
Member at large, David Hayter.
Present.
Okay. So all members are noted as present, with the exception of Executive Secretary Ryan Velez. As one of Ryan's last acts, he prepared the meeting minutes from our July meeting. So I'll go ahead and ask the executive board, let's go ahead and vote on the meeting minutes unless there's any discussion. Okay, all members of the board in favor of the meeting minutes from July, signify by raising your hand and saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
I will abstain since I did not attend the last meeting that we had.
Okay, so the vote for that is...
5-0.
Yeah, 5-0-1 with Velez absent. Okay. Next item on the agenda is the executive board vote on the budget. All members in favor of the executive board budget as discussed during all of our closed sessions and other meetings, please signify by raising your hand stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And we have one member not present, so that passes 6-0. Okay. I'll ask now for Vice President Unruh to give a summary of the year-end's financials. Chuck.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'll take off my mask, and according to our policy, and go over here and project a little better so maybe you can hear me. Last year was a very fortunate year, considering that we had the pandemic. And we're talking about the finances of this corporation. It was a little unbalanced in the sense of our membership revenue. We knew we'd be down for membership revenue. We projected anywhere from 30 to 50% decrease. Our membership normally runs approximately $2 million, the revenue. And so we were thinking that possibly this threat, this pandemic to chess and over the board chess would be short on the budget. The budget was for -$100,000 approximately when we started. The good news is, thanks to our staff and quick thinking, we now have a footprint in online. We will continue that footprint. We'll have events in the future. And that footprint helped with our membership. And our membership came in. Now we're talking about revenue, not numbers. but came in at $1.5 million, which was a pleasant surprise. We were down approximately 30% instead of the 50%. Now, couple that with a wonderful investment year in, on the expense side, controlling our expenses. Once again, we're very, very careful with our G&A, which is your general and administrative. And there were a lot of decreases in general administrative. When we go out there, we think that our employees that are traveling, travel was minuscule last year, comparatively. So we saved on G&A. We hadn't budgeted for that type of savings, but it was significant. So all in all, we go to the bottom line, and we find out that with the saving, and that we didn't have our national, some of our international events, that the audited financials are going to show over $800,000 worth of surplus for this year. And I say it's a little unbalanced. Next year, maybe investments won't yield as much as they did this year. We're only anticipating in our new budget approximately $88,000. This year, we had over $200,000. I mean, the markets came roaring back, and we can't think that we're going to perform better than our dividends every year and have all these huge capital gains. We really don't know. It may be a fantastic year, but at the same time, it's better to be a little conservative. So this is truly fortunate news. I mean, things just lined up to where we had a good year, and our anticipation of next year, our budget is for a break even, and we're rather modest on the budget. You'll be seeing that as we present it. Our revenue forecast for membership is still not back to pre-COVID days. We don't know where COVID is going right now. I mean, we have the Delta, and we had warnings this morning about Lambda. I'm not a doctor, it's hard for me to tell as on the economic side. And membership revenue is so important to us. Whether we're off 10% or 15% or 20% in the next year, or else we have a boom year, which would be about $2.2 million of revenue membership. Membership revenue, I should say. That is my basic report. It is really, really good in the overall. I describe it as having my feet in the oven and my head in the refrigerator. I feel pretty good on average.
Chuck?
Yes,
one thing you didn't mention related to the Paycheck Protection Program, and that was certainly helpful to us, and I don't know if you want
absolutely.
To comment on that at all.
For our cash flow, the Paycheck Protection Program was very good. Our first one was $229,000 when the world seemed to be flying apart, and that secured our structure. And securing our structure and adding comfort to that we could keep all of our employees is a wonderful program. Now, on the bottom line, the Paycheck Protection Program is going to be, the liability for it will be in this next fiscal year. What does that mean? It doesn't affect the $800,000 plus surplus for this year. Has the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, doesn't affect this year. This meaning the last fiscal year. So in the next fiscal year, we'll be taking that loan one in June. Our year starts June 1. And that is $229,000 that'll hit the bottom line.
That is because it's been forgiven.
Because it's been forgiven,
right.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Vice President.
And Chuck,
Carol?
I think everybody who's been to meetings before is probably aware, but today's preview of the year-end financials, there'll be a more in-depth presentation at tomorrow's budget and finance workshop. I think it's 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon or something. Along those lines, we just got the audited financial draft yesterday afternoon, so we've been going over it and making some very minor changes. We'll get it printed overnight and have it for everybody to see tomorrow afternoon. So.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Andrew, Virginia, we want to ask about the rating fees, if you have a window in there as far as, that's also a steady stream of revenue for U.S. chess, and even with online chess, it's still significantly less, it would figure. I don't know if you can inform us as far as, you know, the degree of that shortfall was for last fiscal year.
I'd have to look into the exact numbers. There was a shortfall, but it's not a significant shortfall as compared to our membership revenue. And with the recovery and more tournaments that are scheduled or rating fees, hopefully we'll get back to pre-COVID.
We just put them flat, though, in terms of the budget, just keeps them at last year's.
Yeah, we keep them flat.
So we're not, if we get more, that's great. It'll just be additive to the bottom line.
Yeah, it's about $90,000 a year. Yeah,
we're talking about $180,000 on a $5 million corporation now. It's not that it isn't, every little bit helps and every little bit is significant, but we're just so glad that we're seeing some type of recovery in the over-the-board chess. Because that was an existential threat, threatening to put us out of business. Other questions?
Okay, so if you have more detailed questions tomorrow at the budget workshop, you know, Chuck will be able to
answer them all.
That's right. Do all that song
well,
and dance.
To the best of my ability.
Do all that song and dance. Thank you, Chuck. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
I'd like to call now on Hal Terry as president of the U.S. Open Committee to summarize for us, you know, the excellent work that he and his committee have done to help the executive board look into the U.S. Open future so that we can keep this event, U.S. Chess's real flagship event, and improve it based on what we're seeing in terms of the how members seem to be really voting with their feet in terms of participation. Hal, floor is yours.
Right. Hal Terry, New Hampshire. First of all, there is a lengthy printed report that's available for all this, and when I get home and get my scanner fixed, I'm going to put together this thing that anyone who wants it can ask, and I'll send it to them. But simply to summarize the discussions from yesterday, first of all, everybody is pretty much on board with the idea that the one-week format is inevitable. So that's a go. Now there are some, there's a change that's going to be needed. I'm going to explain in a moment. And then there's a whole series of modifications to the site specifications that you're going to need to have. And I'll go through that as well. And I'm going to summarize all this in an email I'm sending to Boyd at his request. First of all, one of the things that Boyd is requesting is some additional flexibility for the office to dates being offered to prospective hotels. So he wants the last weekend in July and the first two full weeks in August available. And to make that possible, DACI 1999-09, which currently specifies that the U.S. Open may finish no later than August 15, will have to be changed since it is not a guarantee that August the 1st will fall on a Monday. So I'm working on some language for a delegate motion. I'm going to put that in the agenda for this weekend to get that passed.
Does that, just so I'm clear, does that include the one extra week up front that y'all were talking about as well?
No change is needed for that because the DACI in question only dealt with
the back end.
So you can go as early as you want,
right,
but we need the flexibility to go two full weeks into August. And that's the second half of that DACI. The first one is just the sentence that says no round of the U.S. Open may be scheduled to conflict with the delegates meeting. And that part is fine.
Okay.
Okay, so as far as the site specifications go, The Invitational is going to have a major impact on this. Right now, with the two-weekend format, the Invitationals play their last game Tuesday morning, and the six-day schedule doesn't begin until Tuesday evening. Boyd already noted that if that wasn't the case, it would have overflowed the ballroom. Now, currently, you have five Invitationals, you know, with a potential of 250 players. At some point, surely before 2025, the next two are going to be implemented. Now you're looking at 350 players. And also you have the possibility that, you know, there have been proposals for a disabled Invitational and one for adult women. So now you're looking maybe at 450 players. Now, I don't recall exactly what the specification is currently for the ballroom. My guess would be about 50,000 square feet. But you know, you're looking potentially, especially you know, when you compress it to just Monday through Sunday, it's now impossible to keep the Invitationals separate from the 6 day. So the current size of the ballroom would not be adequate. Either you need something double that size, or my recommendation would be, especially since you have these two new ones that are very young players, you need a larger ballroom and maybe what they would call a junior ballroom, say between 5 and 8,000 square feet. Enough to hold 100 people with generous spacing, and you have, they're isolated, those young players, you have lots of control just like you do with the National Scholastics. So, you know, all of that is going to affect the specifications. And then during the discussions, somebody said, well, if you're renting the ballroom for a week, they're just throwing in the side rooms for free. And I was a little skeptical about that. I don't know if that's true or not. You know, the committee suggested that, well, you know, you need to move all the workshops online. And before 2025, that makes these rooms, which you've already committed to, available possibly for revenue producing events. But after, you know, starting in 2025, well, maybe you save money if you don't ask for all these extra rooms. But if they're free, then I guess you could just take them anywhere. But I don't know if that's the case. You know, so that's
I can clarify that. Generally the revenue model with the hotels is that they rely on a room rate and hotel room rate to offset any losses from not generating revenue from us renting the space. So I believe we get the space for free if we meet a certain room block commitment. It's usually 80% of the total room block that we take on.
Now, another element that affects the specifications is that one of the committee's recommendations is to look at the possibility of adding a major Grand Prix event in the final weekend, configured in such a way that it's impossible to play both in the U.S. Open and in this other event. The idea is that, and you do it in sections, so it's not all one like U.S. Open, so people who are disappointed in their U.S. Open score may withdraw, enter the final weekend event, and pay another entry fee. Plus you get all the people, you know, from the surrounding area who just want a one weekend event. Now this is, of course, an experimental idea, but if it's going to be tried, then you need space for maybe 100 people somewhere during the day on Saturday and Sunday. But typically, at least half the ballroom is being set up for the delegates meeting. And I would not want to be playing on the other side of one of those thin dividers when somebody was holding forth on some esoteric motion or other. So, you know, all of this needs to be taken into consideration, exactly what's available, at the site. We did get a comment at US Open Workshop from someone who will certainly recognize himself, but I agree with it. We had a significant problem with the lighting in the ballroom this year, and this is not the first time this has happened. And the recommendation is that it needs to be written into the contract that a certain level of illumination is in the ballroom, because you can't just get blindsided by this. We need to have contractual remedy for that kind of thing.
That was a joke, wasn't it? Blindsided.
Now, finally, with the invitationals, there was a considerable debate in the invitationals committee about the possibility of, you know, de-linking the event, since the invitationals are becoming so large. And after a while, pretty much everyone came to the conclusion is no, the link with the US Open should be maintained. So that means that all these space considerations are definitely in play. And that's pretty much where things stand now. And I'll certainly, you know, copy all of you with the message that I sent the board.
What's,
questions?
And maybe I just missed it. With, what's been the trend among the players, you know, the 9-day, the 6-day, the 4-day, where, you know, is there an area where they're kind of gravitating toward now, and
oh,
it's
yes,
informing things for
that
us?
That was one of the first things that we discovered. Over the last 5 years, the trend is away from the traditional schedule into the 6-day, but not the 4-day. In other words, players want to spend less money, fewer days, but they don't want to play the fast control. They want to play the slow control, and they're willing to play multiple games a day to get it. And this year's event is, you know, it does not match up with any of the trends. It's like the traditional schedule is back up to like 37-38%, and maybe even a little bigger than the 6-day. But this is, you know, everyone is not doing typical things at this event. But it is over 500 here. Now, I would say that in exchange for making all these changes, when you guys start looking for a hotel, we want something, okay? We want better hotels, better located.
Define better located.
Well, not isolated like Phoenix or next year.
You mean California? Yeah.
Even here, you're practically, if you don't have a car, a prisoner in the hotel. And you know, this was probably a really great hotel once, and everyone here, the staff is very nice and friendly, but I see there are serious maintenance issues all over the building. Right down the hall, there's water dripping from the ceiling into a bucket. You know, and I've heard from a lot of players, they've had real issues in their sleeping rooms. Missing furniture, non-functioning equipment like the coffee maker.
Televisions.
You know, this whole place needs a complete refurbishing.
Yeah, and to be, you know, I'm not trying to make excuses here, but maybe it's just a fair comment. But it's unfortunate we're the recipient of it. We're kind of the test case for this hotel getting back its feet back on the ground because of the COVID. They've been closed. You know, most of the staff that we're working with are all new people. So clearly things like maintenance hasn't been looked at. And I agree that that's just an excuse. And those things should have all been taken care of, you know, by the property manager. And, you know, and they haven't. And that's disappointing.
One of the things I would note is I direct a lot of tournaments, and I've directed a lot since the pandemic sort of waned, I won't say ended. I have noticed in all the tournaments that I've directed for many different organizations, all of the hotels, without exception, are not as good as they were pre-pandemic. The great hotels became good, the good hotels became okay, the okay hotels became, well, You know, so everybody dropped their game a little bit. And if you started from a good place, the drop wasn't as noticeable or as significant. So, you know, but we have noticed every single hotel without exception is still trying to get back on their feet post-pandemic.
Yeah, and that's fair. But I guess it's location that's more important. The key to having a good turnout of players for the U.S. Open is to have a lot of players available for that in the local area. And you saw it here this year, we're over 500. And you saw it in Phoenix. And with a little work, they did the same thing in Vancouver back in 2012. But if you can find someplace, you know, I would say it would be okay to deviate a little bit from the tradition of strict geographic rotation. If you can find sites that are, you know, close to urban areas with high concentrations of players, you know, which would make some of these additional, you know, revenue enhancing ideas possible, because there are people even in those locations who won't give up a whole week but might come for a weekend.
There's kind of a Venn diagram when you're taking into consideration the factors in U.S. Open. You've got cost, you've got quality, you've got location, and you know they all, finding the perfect mix is hard. So an example of a very nice hotel is the Biltmore in Phoenix. You know, we couldn't get many tournaments there except the fact it's Phoenix at the time of year it is. But at the same time, as you suggested, you have problems because there isn't much around it. And you know, we have been to some places where we didn't necessarily draw as well that are what you would consider good locations. Indianapolis, the last time we were there, and some of that was hotel considerations as to its quality. We got put into a less quality facility. So it's just hard to find the perfect mix with the short time frame that we have, even if we don't take into consideration geographic, the wish to move it around the country.
Okay, so what you're getting only one weekend now, and you're getting three possible weeks to choose from.
Well, that's right. And that
should improve
the
prospects.
We'll see. You know, it's all kind of a case-by-case basis, too. We had a really good turnout in Madison. The second time we went back there, we again had problems with other events that were going on in the area that you really can't know about when you're booking it as many years in advance as we do. So we're still going to have those kinds of issues.
Of course.
The other consideration is that schools are tending to start earlier and earlier. Mm-hmm. So that's another consideration of the flexibility of the weeks. Do we bump it back earlier in order to get those students there at the tournament?
What about 2 weeks into July? Look back 2 weeks into July.
Well, what Boyd requested was only going back 1 week into July.
And the problem there is governance related. If we are going to hold the delegates meetings with the U.S. Open, for example, we just got our audit back today. If you move those meetings into July, you're going to have problems with the election cycle and you're going to have problems with our financial cycle. It all, you know, it's all this,
it's together,
this interconnectivity.
Yeah, there's no isolation of activities.
And we don't really want to disassociate this meeting with the Open because we want our members to participate.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Davis?
I just wanted to ask Hal or others in the room if there have been particular locations we've been to in the past that you did like better, that you would better fit the criteria you're asking for.
Vancouver.
Okay.
Sure. Vancouver, Norfolk was a great location, although I don't
turnout
know why
wasn't
we didn't
so
get
good.
Turnout there. But if you want to go really far back, 1988 Boston, that was great.
That was a good.
complicated.
And the 87 one, which was also in...
with Portland.
Portland, Oregon, right. That was a great location, right downtown.
And we have looked, for example, again at Vancouver. The problem is the hotel is not willing to give us the terms that we want, and that's always the challenge.
$200-something a room night, you know, it's...
But you're going to have a lot of flexibility, with the invitationals maintaining their link. The attrition clauses are not going to be an issue at all. You can offer anything you want.
How high a room rate is too high? Because, I'd love to go to Vancouver. It's a great yeah. city.
Well, right now we're up to around 140 for the next few years. I don't know. My understanding is that, at the Super Nationals, is a really high rate.
The parents all pay. 179.
Pardon?
179.
Yeah, 179. So, yeah, up to a point, you can do that, but then you're going to have people opting to
But it's only three nights six. For most people, for the Super Nationals. So, yeah.
The invitational players, those families, I think more of them stay here, at the site, the host site, than opt to surrounding hotels. That's just my impression.
Andy?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think the latter impression is correct, because I know that a couple state associations I've been, they do fundraising just for that very purpose, to make sure that they get the representation, and that includes the lodging. I wanted to make a point of information, if you will, with regards to Norfolk, Virginia. That was a very good site. At the time, the Hampton Throats Chess Club was in transition, and they had, for these local events, as far as trying to get a higher local percentage of turnout, it's very helpful to have an active local chess club holding real-life tournaments. And in that area, they were in transition. Currently, they're healthy, but 3 years ago, they were not. So that was a little bit of bad luck in that regard. I think that if it were to return to that site, the local turnout would be considerably better.
Yeah, they have 225 members and almost 200 on a wait list. So they're looking for a bigger facility to have their club meetings in.
Wow.
Of course, that is collapsing. The adult club is still running on the order of about 20 to 25 players per night.
And we've had some bad luck, too. The St. Louis, I think, would be a good turnout. That's a good population center.
Well, that's on my radar.
And, last year, of course, we couldn't hold it because of government order. The last time we were supposed to hold it, the hotel closed. Sometimes you just can't control.
Somebody over here had their hand up. Yeah, go ahead.
Would it be possible to, especially with the youngest kids and the invitational, to reduce the time control? Cut it by half, and that way you might finish them completely before the 6 day starts. After all, the little kids have an attention span about the 8 day. So.
I think these are my comment is that these are not just these are not unrated players. Many of these kids are they're state champions, and they're coming here with an expectation to play. A long time control. And I agree with you, a game may be finished in 3 minutes, but I think you'll get a lot of pushback from the parents that the players, they're entitled to play the long time control just like everybody else is, because some of these kids are rated over 2,000.
What about the K-3 players? You're going to get pushback on the K-3 player parents?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We get it at the Nationals because the Scholastic Council has tried lowering time controls, and they just get tremendous pushback from the parents, we want to keep the longer time controls for our kids.
They don't mind their potentially at this event here, having kids play around at 7 p.m. at that age.
We do it at the Nationals, So.
I would agree though with you, because all of these are champions from their state. So some of the ratings of them are very high and significant. Others are small, but we're not talking about a regular tournament. These are the top players.
But I think it's also possible to to keep the noise down and those kinds of things. That it might be you might have the the youngest kids are in a separate, I mean, because you could fit it all in this room right here kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, have them in a separate room so that it's not disturbing to the, you know, to the older players, and some players are just very sensitive to the noise, but the little kids usually aren't. So, yes, go ahead.
Mike Nolan, Nebraska, just in case nobody knew me.
Hard to tell with the masks on.
It is harder, yes. I've only been going to the U.S. Open since 1986, and in that time, just kind of casting back, we've had close to 10 examples where the hotel either changed ownership or was either closed or almost closed by the time we got there. One time where a week or two before we got there in Chicago, they started a major renovation, and they were jacking the floors in at 6 a.m. And there's a risk you're always going to have associated with a long contract that I think it was a previous operations person told me that in all the tournaments she had worked with, never did the person who was in charge of sales at the time the event was held was not the same person who signed the contract.
Yeah. Not unusual at all.
We got Bill Brock over there.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Bill.
With the move to 7-day, would it be possible to split the traditional U.S. Open into two parts, where you had, similar to the U.S. Amateur Team, where you had four different weekend, you know, first stage of the U.S. Open events, where people could play at a traditional time control over a 3-day weekend and get the first three rounds in. And I realize that maybe only the people are 2 points above might come, but it's not that different than what we have right now with the multiple sections. It would spread interest in the tournament around, and it would make the move more palatable to your traditional players who, like me, quite a bit, are only about a third of the players on this event. And I don't see any downside, because you could potentially squeeze 10 or 11 games in to keep the traditional format. And that's not a today thing. I just throw it out there.
Gosh, I can't begin to list the downsides I see.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of ways that you can improve tenants and make a profit every time you run an event if you want to basically do away with the U.S. Open. You know, change it into one of these multi-section weekend events. Not everyone would agree with me, but my opinion is U.S. Senior Open no longer exists. U.S. Senior Open traditionally was a 6-round event, one game per day. Okay, but that's gone now. It's a weekend event, game in 90, 30-second increments. And to be fair, they have now routinely eclipsed the all-time record from 2002 in the previous format. I admit that, but it's not the same tournament. If you want to do something like this, the U.S. Open, well, you're going to have a certain bottom line success, probably. But it won't be a U.S. Open anymore.
8:30 round times don't do much for the Senior Open either.
Can you speak up, please? What'd you say?
I said 8:30 round times don't do much for the Senior Open either.
AM or PM?
Yeah. Andy,
either.
I wanted to make mention as far as the formats, and there'll be, I'm sure that we'll get even more when we're at our delegates meeting. It's very difficult to get one size to fit all, but on the other hand, there have been modifications in the past. I'm sure there were people who were not thrilled about going from 12 rounds to 9 rounds. And similarly, the matter of going from a traditional to a 6-day, there are going to be people who will, as Mike Hoffmeyer has noted, will vote with their feet and will choose to not play. But there will be other people that figure to be game in that. And again, while you know the changes that Hal Terry has mentioned, you know, it'll be a goodly bit of observation on the fly when these happen, and you know we're not locked in for decades of our new format, so to speak. So, you know, I think that should also be taken into consideration as well.
Ken?
And I see we're getting some reactions, but that's okay.
We've wandered around to a number of topics, but I'd like to return to what I think is the core problem if you're considering making this change, and that's Wednesday. The overlap between an expanded invitational program and the 6-day is going to cause a major collision on Wednesdays, and until you solve that problem, it's just as infeasible. I think it's going to, the devil is always in the details, and the details of dealing with room nights and space and what requirements you have for the contractor, all of that stuff is all going to revolve around how many people are you going to have on site wanting to play chess under nice conditions on Wednesday.
Go ahead.
Paul Covington, representing Colorado, living in Oklahoma. Strange situation. If you go to a 6-day model for the U.S. Open, the cost savings on the hotel nights would enable people to spend the same amount of money as the traditional, but with a little bit higher cost for the hotel room for nicer hotels. Just a comment.
Any other discussion? Any other executive board member questions? Okay, well, Hal, thank you for the work the committee's been doing. Please continue, you know, based on some of the options and ideas you had today. If you all have some additional thoughts that you will, after you think things through after this meeting is all over, just pass them our way so we have them. I have a question for Carol. Have we looked into the possibility yet from the office of, shall I call it, using this 6-day schedule in any of our current hotel contracts as we go forward?
We have not explored that yet. The board, you know, gave that direction.
Yeah.
July or June, I don't remember which, and we just haven't had an opportunity, but that's on the agenda for early this fall to start. And so we may wind up with a situation where the U.S. schedule, open schedule, might not be consistent for the next few years, where 1 year it might be a shorter schedule, and then the following year, because the hotel doesn't give us the flexibility we're looking for, it may revert back to the schedule we now currently have. We just don't know because those conversations haven't yet happened.
Okay, and even before we pull the trigger on that, you know, we're going to have a pretty serious discussion about it, because we would not want to confuse the players. You know, like we did 6 days last year. Why are we back to this long? What's going on? You know, so there's some significant messaging that has to occur as part of that decision process.
Yeah, I'm not sure the board is united. I'm not united in necessarily doing a lot of jumping around. I'm not sure that's where we want to put our time and energy. So that would be something we would have.
Exactly. Okay. Well, I appreciate all the discussion and the questions and the points that have been made on this. Moving to the next topics, executive meeting plans for the coming business year. And I just wanted to share with the membership that I really thank all the executive board members this past year, because we had we couldn't meet in person like we would before. And, you know, the dynamics of Zoom as opposed to, you know, being able to hang out at the bar and talk through some issues after you're formally meeting during the day, and the fragmentation of issues going from month to month to month, and they keep dragging on. That's been a difficult, but I appreciate all the patience on the part of the board members and the butt kicking that occurred when it needed to occur. But fortunately, I think this coming year, what are we budgeted for? three total in-person meetings, Carol?
Correct.
Yeah, so what it's looking like right now, and so that the membership is aware, Randy's been a big part of the process, and Alan kind of implemented it when Alan was president, and then we've kept it going, which is, we have this cycle of meetings, and the meetings have themes to them. So in our December timeframe, November, December, we look at the strategy for U.S. Chess. So we'll review the mission, the goals, the objectives, and so forth. And that we have a primary meeting just to discuss that. But we also have some preliminary discussions about our budget, which set the stage for our next in-person meeting, which usually occurs February, March-ish. And that's where we do a very deep dive on budget, planning ahead. And as you may have noticed in the financial statement for this year, we've gone to a two-year budget now instead of just the 1 year like we've had in the past. So the 2 year, you know, and it's sort of a rolling, you could change it every year as you go to the next year, as you look forward one additional year, you can change the next year that's coming up. And then after the February, March meeting on budget, usually the next time we have a big EB meeting is in the May-ish time frame, and that's really our meeting to kind of get ready for the delegates meeting as we prepare for the, you know, for the annual delegates meeting. And then we meet in person again here at the delegates meeting like we're doing now. I think what we're going to do, at least what I would recommend as the current president, I would recommend that we continue the monthly meetings in between, but we can bite-size what we're really talking about instead of, because we initially planned for our, you know, our monthly meetings to last like an hour and a half, 2 hours, and they were starting to drag out to, you know, three hours and so forth at the end, which really got, you know, it gets too long because of people's attention span is just limited when you have, you know, those Zoom meetings like that. So we can, you know, take it on a month-by-month basis in between the in-person meetings if there's specific topics that we want to nail down and focus on as we move forward. But that would be what I'd recommend whoever, you know, is the next president of the organization. But that's something we decide as a board.
Yeah, I mean, so. I think it's helpful just for context, too. The board does do a fair amount of voting electronically, but we've been advised by council that unless those are unanimous votes, it has to be done in an actual meeting that's conducted, as they can be when we meet on the phone or in person. So we kind of have to have some of that if it's an issue that isn't going to get, you know, unless everybody's going to vote and is in unanimity. So there's probably a reason for continuing that.
So the thinking right now is that potentially our next meeting would be in December, and we're going to give a hard look at having our meeting in Orlando during the consistent with the K-12 grade nationals. So that way, executive board members who have never seen the melee that occurs at one of those tournaments, anybody who's got TD qualification, we could throw them on the floor too. But
good luck.
Yeah.
K through one.
But that's probably where we'll meet for that one. But we have not decided on any places for the for the meetings that are after that. Andy.
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not staying at the Holiday Inn, so I don't know the answer to this question with regards to unanimous on the board. If somebody's absent and you have a 6-0 vote, still, but you have that one person absent, is that considered to be unanimous?
No. Everybody has to vote
right
for it affirmatively. That we do have a lawyer on the board. That's your understanding, isn't it, Dave? So
just to clarify, when you're talking about voting outside of a meeting, unanimous means everyone votes in favor. But someone who's absent outside of a meeting is not voting in favor.
Right.
Helps.
How would that be different from an in-person meeting where you don't have one of your members here?
It's just different. If you're have an in-person meeting and somebody's absent, and you vote 6-0 without the maps, and it passes.
It's Illinois corporate law.
But if you're doing, it's dictated by corporate law. Every state corporate code is written this way.
Hal?
Yeah, I'm a little confused. I seem to recall records of executive board meetings going back years and years in which email votes were conducted with all kinds of different phone calls.
Yeah, we can't, what we found out was that we were in violation of corporate law.
We have smarter lawyers now.
So, but and I'll let David correct me on what I probably is gonna.
Is 501(c)(3) to change that?
No.
No, not at all.
No, no.
And the issue is when you have a vote, the vote is intended to be in a face-to-face environment, whether face-to-face is over Zoom or whether face-to-face is in person. But it's a face-to-face vote where there has been discussion of the issue that's present. And when you do it just solely by email, the discussion, and you violate the face-to-face part of the whole deal. David, any?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. So.
You know, we don't change our corporate bylaws as directors. None of what we've done is invalidated by that fact. But we now know that,
we're ignorant.
Maybe not exactly the word we'd want to use. But.
So that's sort of the context for our meetings that we've had this past year and that what we, looking at going forward. I want to also give a shout out and thank all the volunteers that have given a lot of time over the past year, especially during COVID, to the different committees that they work on. I know that work is it can be very time consuming at times, because I was on committees. That's how I grew up through U.S. Chess Governance, was on committees. So that work can be time consuming. But I'd also want to put out a general call for people among the membership who want to become part of a committee and get involved in the governance process. As Randy had noted during our closed meeting this morning, how many of our people have been on committees since,
the
last
century?
Yeah, I was going to say the last century. And it's a lot. And we need new blood to come in, not just to inject new ideas, but to be the ability to carry on. And we all saw, with the very untimely and unfortunate passing of people like Ken Ballou and Carol Jarecki,
Harold, really
key people in key positions where you really don't quite know what they were doing until something like this happens. Then you see, oh my God, they were doing pretty much everything in that committee and just teeing things up for the committee members. And not to say that that's wrong or there's any problem with that, but that's a lot of burden that you really didn't realize that some people were taking on. And then when that person is no longer there, you really, really feel it as not only just as a committee, but it affects the organization as a whole. So that's why we need to keep circulating in new people and bringing new people into the fold.
And we have talked as a board about putting something on the website to solicit feedback from individuals that are interested in serving in some capacity on committees. Because it is important for us to, encourage more involvement. I look around the room and there are great faces, people that I really enjoy and have worked with for a long time. But it's a lot of the same faces, and we need to bring some new faces into these kinds of gatherings.
Can I say something on that? If you're in this room or if you're listening to this recording, you almost by definition are far more interested in U.S. chess governance than most people are. And if you're not on a committee and you have an area of passion or a desire to serve, watch for that to come on the website. Mm-hmm. Put your name in. Let's try to find a spot that would be a good fit for you.
Ernie?
Rules and TDCC committees do just about all their work via email. How does this change to the board affect the committees?
It doesn't. You're
okay,
advisory
you.
To us.
Not governance part. So
this has to do with the status of the board of directors.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I thought, but I wanted to check.
That's actually an issue I raised 10 years ago. So.
We just now got around to it.
Back.
Just a suggestion and thought. If you're looking at new blood, I really don't know if we've taken advantage of technology, but Zoom meetings are great to get those people that, you know, are new out there, but they may not be able to attend, but at least you can get them out in these remote areas, especially to take back to their communities and to be able to work and do something they're passionate about. Because all this week, I've been talking to so many people from, you know, because we have the 50 state, you know, representatives here, and talking with parents, they are very interested, but they're out in the remote sticks of, you know, I'm sorry,
yeah,
Wyoming or, you know, some other places, and, you know, and they do want to help out. I think it's a matter of having the Federation figure out that niche and how to draw them in easier for them and make it more, much more convenient. If there's some kind of a link of a training or opportunity sessions.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir on that one.
I am.
Another factor in this committee process that we've talked about is just really ensuring that what we have in the committees is a regional representation, so that you don't get just people from one or two clusters of areas. Randy had pointed out that one of the committees had people that was West Coast and East Coast, and there's nobody in the representing, there's no Midwest, Central United States representation at all in the committee. So that's one of the things that we're gonna pay more attention to as an executive board for the EB appointed committees. And I would urge the delegates to use the same logic as they look at the delegate appointed committees, to making sure that you've got the right kinds of representation from across the nation that the delegates as a body feel is necessary for that, you know, for those particular functions.
One of the other points that I'd make, and your point is well taken, Maureen, is that, you know, last year we couldn't have these meetings in person, and we did do them by Zoom, and I think we had pretty good participation. And I think Hal even raised this in the discussions around the U.S. Open. You know, we can go to a structure, a hybrid structure, where we have those workshops online also. And then you get more opportunity for participation from people across the spectrum of our membership. So I think that fits in well with the whole concept of doing something.
Yeah, we actually test drove it this year with the Tournament Director Certification Committee, because the chair, the vice chair, they couldn't be here, and a majority of their, a significant number of their members couldn't be here. We just said, okay, let's try this out and see how it works. And it worked very well, a lot of good discussion, you know, lots of tournament directors dialing in to the workshop to be a part of it. So I think it holds a lot of promise in multiple, it has multiple benefits. So,
Mike?
Somebody's got a question right there.
Steve Doyle.
Yeah, Steve.
New Jersey. So I was actually going to make a different observation about the attendees in this room.
Can everybody hear him over there?
No. Oh, you can't hear me? Oh, I'm sorry. Usually that's never an issue. You know, I was making a different observation just sitting here, that everybody on the front dais was not involved in U.S. chess when I started. And almost everybody in this room was. Now, maybe I just bridged two generations of people, because I was president back in the 80s, seems like 1,000 years ago, in another way, just yesterday. And I think you've done a great job of recruiting new people into the organization. That's a continuous issue. You always have to try and strike out. You know, I remember putting an ad in Chess Life, and our current ratings chairman answered the ad, Mark Lichtman. John McCrary, never heard of the guy, wrote me a letter and said, I'd like to be involved in chess. And that's how you get new people involved. They have to have an interest. You have to kind of suck them in a little bit. I remember this woman called Carol Jarecki came to my chess club, and I got her sucked into chess because her son was playing chess. This guy, Frank Camerata, you know, we love chess sets, and we started to share chess sets. The next thing I know, we had to go out of business. So, you know, you suck people in, you get them involved, and we find that mutual interest. And I applaud you. I think you've done a great job.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you.
Has the board considered either encouraging or directing the board committees to do significant meetings by Zoom instead of email?
The committees have the ability to decide that now. They can do that now.
Someone over.
Yeah, Alex
is
the most committed. Randy mentioned hybrid meetings. Does that mean the workshops are going to be online, but meetings in
it means that there would be the possibility that the workshops occur online as Zoom meetings to enable greater attendance among the membership and also to free up facility that we may need to use for other purposes because we, you know, have more invitationals and so forth going on. Does that answer your question, Alex?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions on that? Okay. Last person I'd like to thank is someone who is, you know, on very short notice has stepped up, you know, with all of us that are delegates know that Ken Ballou has been our parliamentarian, voted every year as the parliamentarian. And when Ken, rest his soul, passed, we were like, oh my God, what do we do? Because now he's going to be, you know, up there parliamentarian somewhere else.
In the sky.
Yeah. But so we, you know, Mike Nolan came to mind and we started talking to Mike. And Mike, I just want to publicly thank you for stepping up for us this year to be our, you know, candidate to get voted in as the parliamentarian for the meeting. But thank you very much. And about a round of applause for Mike. That's the end of the formal agenda. Mike Niedman, go ahead.
At the membership meeting, can elect up to 5 delegates to go into the delegates meeting. I'm collecting names. I have 2 at this point. So if you're not a delegate and have served as a delegate in the last 5 years, see me sometime before the membership meeting. I'll put you on the list. Thank you. I have the attendance sheet. Who wants that?
Has anyone not signed yet? I think there's some folks down near me have not signed the attendance sheet.
Anybody sign it?
Right. Nope.
Okay, so that ends the budget. I mean the agenda items that I had. So the floor is open for general questions.
We've been doing that.
Do we go to a 6-day model and not have a 4-day model? How much impact would that have? Because that would allow us to federate those events, I believe.
Hal, was there was no discussion about getting rid of the 4 days, right?
No, this is like a question off the floor.
No, we've talked about, I mean, literally we've talked about wanting the possibility that this tournament be FIDE rated, number one, and number two, that if we can do it, that it becomes ability to have norms out of it. But in order to do that, you can have to have some sectioning that occurs. It wouldn't be the normal open, because if you just have a normal open, you're not going to have enough, right? You know, you just won't have enough rating to be able to meet criteria to be a, you know, to be a norm tournament. You'd have to have, for example, you know, a quote championship section where you got to have a 2200 rating even to get in it, kind of thing.
I mean, in order to make norms, you have to.
You have to have foreign players,
and you have, even if they're there, you have to play them. Mm-hmm. And by the nature of the Swiss, your early pairings are just going to prevent any legitimate chance at a norm. A realistic chance of a norm. Okay. So, in order to make it a norm event, you would absolutely have to. It wouldn't have to be limited to 2200, but it would have to be limited in some meaningful way to.
And we may have to pay to have people that have foreign titles to come play.
Yeah. And then you get into that answers my question. It's just not doable. Okay.
You could have hyper acceleration as a workaround. I think that's a lot of the media, but maybe not for golf events.
It introduces some issues. Yeah. I'd have to look to see if those issues could be overcome, but it certainly introduces some issues.
But getting it FIDE rated is relatively easy, but having it be norm capable, that's another ball game altogether right there.
The FIDE rating, the tournament has been FIDE rated. That's not an issue.
Right.
That's doable. Whether it can generate GM norms and IM norms.
Yeah.
You can always advertise it as available. It's just realistically, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm.
Other questions?
We got a lot of people norms back in the 80s and early 90s. We did a variation of Bill Brock's method. We had small events on weekends that had all the qualifiers. They played against the foreign players with the titles. And then we merge when it would open. You can do something like that that completely allow voter vote to be they rule. Then you could actually trick the system to allow it. It's actually very clever.
It's interesting.
I can explain it to you.
But we can do that with the 6-day schedule and the 4-day schedule going on concurrently, right?
Yeah.
They're going to merge into 1 day.
And that it's doing norms when you have a merge schedule becomes not, it's just not possible anymore.
Now you also have some limitations. You have to be careful about the 2 games a day
and
the total time.
12 hours of play, the rate of play. So there are, I mean, all those issues could be overcome, but you have to pay attention to them, is all.
Thank you.
Somebody else, Ernie, do you have a hand up?
No.
Okay. Just stretching. Mike.
I have one question. What is the timeline for the board, and I'm asking on behalf of the National State Invitations Committee, what is the timeline for the board's decision on possibly when the Ashley tournament might start?
So we say 1 o'clock today, is that good? No. I don't. Carol, any thoughts on that?
So I think it probably won't be launched until we're out of our current set of contracts unless we can make adjustments to the contracts that are already on the books.
Yeah, and then the difficulty there has been what you wouldn't want to have, you do it 1 year and then the next year you can't.
Right.
That would be a mistake, big
right.
time.
I agree.
Yeah. So.
Okay, thank you.
And just for everybody's edification, what contracts do we have on the books?
So next year, Southern California, Palm Springs area. The following year, I believe it's Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah.
And then the third year, it's back in Norfolk at the same property we were at in 2017.
So we'll get to test that.
And then 2025 is the first opportunity to really do things differently.
When it comes to Norfolk, we're going to work like crazy to have something like the Blitz tournament on the battleship or something. I mean, there's just
that'd be cool.
There's just some incredible possibilities down there, and that place has really grown since the last time we were there.
Especially
any other questions?
The weather deck, Mike.
Yeah. Any other questions?
We'll adjourn.
Yep. So I thank everyone for attending our meeting, and so this meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Hey, Alan.
No.